So if you remember when Rob was talking about the overview of Ruth, the very first part of Ruth, it talks about the time period that Ruth happened. And it's in the time of the judges. And the book of Judges is a weird book. And you kind of see a real cyclical pattern happen in that book where the people of Israel, they turn to God, they're worshiping God, everything's good. Then they turn away from God, they do what's evil in the sight of the Lord. Everyone does what's right in his own eyes, and then they get conquered, and then God appoints a judge because they turn back to God. He rescues them out. Then they turn away from God, they get conquered, rescues them out. It's just consistently back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And this phrase always happens. It says, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And it's a really constant theme. A lot of times, I think, when we read the Bible and we think about Bible days or Bible times, sometimes we think that it's a place that we would never be or a place we would never end up. Because sometimes it's hard to put ourselves in that place because the culture's different, how people act are a little bit different. C.S. Lewis described it as chronological snobbery. Talked about this idea that we can look at where we're at now and say, well, we would never be that bad. We would never do those things. So when you think about this idea, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. I read this article this week that I just want to share. It has nothing to do with Ruth specifically, but stick with me. The largest growing trend for marriages, and it's not just in America, it's sweeping over the world, and I'm not good at saying words that are made up, but it's effectively sologamy. What it is a single person marries themselves. They have an actual ceremony. Their friends and their family come to this ceremony. They get all dressed up. Everybody's dressed up, and they have a legal ceremony to marry themselves. And it's a statement that I don't need a spouse or a partner to complete me. I'm everything I need in myself, and I'm going to marry myself. So when we're looking at Old Testament specifically, and we look at like everyone doing what was right in his own eyes, we're morally past that. We're better than that now in 2017. We make better choices and we have different things. We absolutely don't. We make horrible choices. And if you're coming off the heels of our marriage series, we went through this amazing marriage series, and if you're kind of sitting thinking like, man, marrying myself, maybe that's a good idea. It's not. Go back and listen to the marriage series because you missed the point. It's a terrible idea, and none of us here are going to be there, okay? So don't do it. So we just want to make sure when we're looking at the Bible that we are not looking at it with chronological snobbery when we look at how people do what they do. So in Ruth, we're going to be in chapter 3. So if you want to turn there, I'm going to read through it. And a lot of times at Gospel Life, we have you stand up when we read through a passage, and it's a physical demonstration that we want to put ourselves under the authority of the Bible. Today, I'm going to have you guys sit. I'm going to read through the entire chapter, and I want you to hear it a little bit differently than maybe sometimes how you hear things. I don't want you to hear it as a lecture or as a passage. I just want you to hear the next scene in a story. Because that's really what this is. Ruth is this beautiful just story, just a narrative that we get to hear and see how it plays out. So I just want you to listen to the story, this new scene in chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went and lie down at the end of a heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lie down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring your garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her, and she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but settle the matter today. Let me pray for us. Father God, thank you for this morning. Thank you for this story of Ruth. Thank you that we get to see how your gospel plays out in the narrative of other people that we get to look at and we get to see how it points to you. In your name, amen. Excuse me. So this is kind of a little bit of a weird scene, and we're going to kind of divide it up a little bit, and we really want to focus in on one verse and explain what it means. But what's happening here is, if you remember last week, Kyle talked about how Ruth found comfort and safety and shelter under the wings of God. And so now Naomi kind of looks out and says, our lives are not good. She knows that their lives aren't good. Ruth is spending her time scratching and pecking for scraps. Boaz shows her a kindness, but she is still simply a beggar, effectively, working hard for minimal amount. And so Naomi hatches this great plan, like, this is how we're going to make your life better. You almost hear it in her words, like, I want to seek rest for you. It's almost like this idea of, I'm done. Like, it's over for me, but it maybe for you, you can have something better. And so we're going to try to do something good for you, but for me, it's over. Remember, bitterness, right? She wanted people to call me bitter, because that's where I'm at. But Ruth, maybe you got a shot at a real life. And so she hatches this amazing plan for Ruth, and Ruth just follows it, listens to her mother-in-law, and says she's going to do it. And when we look at Boaz, it talks about how he was eating, drinking till his heart was merry, and then he slept on a pile of grain. So what's happening here is this is not Boaz just getting so drunk, needs a place to fall down, sees a heap of grain, and collapses, right? It says his heart was merry. Maybe he couldn't operate a motor vehicle at the time, but he didn't have to. That wasn't the standard. There's no .08, no breathalyzers involved. And so what's going on is the threshing floor was a rented space. So during time of harvest, Boaz rented the threshing floor for a period of time to use it. And the reason you slept on your grain is to stop people from stealing it. So for Ruth to come into this context, actually kind of risky. So if I can put myself in that mindset where I'm thinking Boaz has at least one weapon near him, maybe multiples. So for Ruth to kind of sneak in and startle him in the middle of the night, not a great idea, but this is Naomi's plan for her to come in and talk to him. And so when we look at Ruth and Boaz, what's really hard is we don't have recorded sin in the 4 chapters we have. So at Gospel Life, we try to make really strong statements when we look at characters in the Bible that the answer isn't, well, be like Abraham, be like Moses. And usually there's enough of a narrative around there to show how horrible they are. And for everyone to agree, yeah, I don't want to be like that guy. I don't want to prostitute out my own wife to keep me safe. Like there's examples of why we don't want to be like those characters. With Ruth and Boaz, if you look up commentaries, if you're doing any research around the passage, I read several articles that just directly said, be like Boaz. Well, that's not the answer here. And they use this as an example that they're in this setting. Middle of the night, no one around, the opportunity for moral failure is really high, but they both chose not to. So be like Ruth and be like Boaz and say no to sin. But that's not what our answer is. That can't be our answer. And so we want to work really hard against that tendency when we're looking at their story for this week and into next. But where I want to focus in on is in verse 9, where Ruth makes a really strong request. And so in verse 9, Boaz wakes up. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. So as I mentioned, Kyle using that phrase last week about seeking comfort under the wings of God, that it's that same phrase. So literally it can mean like a garment, And so Ruth has uncovered his feet, laying there at night. It can literally mean spread a garment over me. But bigger picture, she's asking him for everything that goes with being redeemed. Not just a marriage proposal, but bringing her under his entire protection. It's a huge ask that she's making of Boaz right now. And now the word redeemer, I think, loses a lot with us, because the only time we hear it is in the context of Jesus, which is not wrong, and we're going to look at that later. But redeemer is one of those super church words. Like, if you're ever at the workplace, you're doing your job, you're hanging out with buddies, does the word redeemer ever come up? Like, no, it only comes up in church. It's a church word, and we only use it in reference to Jesus. We name our churches after it. We write songs where the main focus is being a redeemer. But what does it actually mean? It has different implications than maybe what we always think about. And I want to take a quick second to look at that, and it's in the book of Leviticus. So Leviticus is further back in the Old Testament. It's that place when you start out in January doing your yearly Bible reading, and then about end of January, start of February, this is where you stop because you hit Leviticus, and it's like eating cereal without milk, and it's where you stop. Turns out, there's still some really interesting stuff in Leviticus. It's weird. And so we're going to look at it. This is a spot where God's talking about laws and options, and this is where the idea of a redeemer is presented. And there's other places, but I'm just going to look at two sections. In chapter 25, verse 25, it says, "If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold." So this is in reference to you've fallen on hard times. You've lost your job, your crops haven't produced in the way you thought they were going to produce, and you have debts. You have no way of sustaining yourself. Kind of the first option would be to start selling off stuff. So this is like the worst garage sale that someone could have. This is for my life. I'm going to have this garage sale, and I'm going to sell my property. I'm going to sell all of my things in order to survive. So now imagine in our setting, this is you get laid off. You don't know what to do. You sell your car. You start selling your awesome, I don't know, record collection or whatever you collect. You're selling it, and you're systematically going down, and then you sell your house. You sell your clothes. You sell everything you can because you don't know what else to do. And then your brother hears about it, and your brother has means to help you. And your brother comes and goes to the person you just sold all your stuff to, buys it all back from that person to simply hand it to you. So let that sink in a little bit about what a redeemer means and what it would mean to be redeemed in that setting. You've just sold all your stuff, your property, your house. You don't know what you're going to do. And your brother comes, buys it back, and then gives it to you. A little bit further in Leviticus 25, it talks about the other meaning or the other application of a redeemer. And it's in verse 47. And it says, "If a stranger or sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor, and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you, or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him." So now this is, you've sold all your stuff. You have nothing left to sell. Your brother hasn't heard about it for some reason. Nobody's come to redeem you. You have no other options, and you still have debts. In this culture, you could actually choose to sell yourself into slavery to someone. Now, there's some different implications in this culture than what we as Americans typically think of slavery. When we think about like Abraham Lincoln and some of that slavery that our country experienced, it's a little bit different, but it's still, you're giving away your freedom and your rights, and you're becoming a servant, an indentured servant to someone to do work you don't want to do, to make money for someone else that you don't get to see, to not have any more freedoms that you experienced just a day ago. But your brother hears about it. And your brother shows up and buys you back from that person, and then just, you're free. Unless your brother's like, "Well, now I own you," which hopefully that's a bad redeemer. So the context here, though, the brother would buy you to then set you free. So you go in that span of being free, now I have no options, I sell myself into slavery, and then all of a sudden my brother comes, buys me back, and now I'm free again. That's the idea behind redeemer. So now let's think about what Ruth is talking about. Ruth has no property. She has no options. There's no continuing education for her. There's no night college classes for her to get a degree in something. There's no Pinterest for her to figure out ways to make money with little knits and crafts and stuff. She's got nothing. No chance, no options. And what she's asking of Boaz is to redeem the property and effectively the personhood that she had when she was married to an Israelite. It's a big ask. And underneath that, it's, oh yeah, can we also be happily married? Big ask. With Boaz waking up in the middle of the night thinking he's about to fight someone for his grain. Like, that's his state of mind. So hopefully you don't get woken up in the middle of the night to ask some of the biggest life questions you've ever had to answer before, but that's where Boaz is. But he handles it like a champ. Be like Boaz. No? We talked about it at the beginning, guys. Come on. No, the answer is not be like Boaz. But this is the setting. This is what Ruth is asking of him right now. So let's look at kind of the flow of Ruth's life up until now, and we'll see some parallels with Adam and Eve in the garden. So Ruth, if we remember at the beginning of the story, married, good life. Her mother-in-law didn't call herself bitter, so she might have been a cool mother-in-law at that time. Married, happy. She was a Moabite. And Kyle talked last week more in depth about what Moabite meant. That was not a good thing. So she goes from being a Moabite to where she gets brought in to this clan, this people of God, this cool thing that has privileges that other people don't have. And she gets brought into that. So she has a good life. And then a death happens. And that death affected every single aspect of Ruth's life. That affected her not just the pain of losing a spouse, which obviously would be horrific, but it affected her financially. It affected her socially, because now you know what she is? She's a Moabite again. That's all she is. She's just a Moabite. And yet she's still surrounded by Israelites as a Moabite. It affected her to her core, that death. But now, on the threshing floor with Boaz, Boaz gives her a promise of being redeemed. That promise would have seeped deep into her heart. Because that promise, just that promise itself, affects every aspect of her life, just like that death did. That would take her back from not just being a Moabite. She would be an Israelite. She would be married back into this thing. She would have a life. She would have a shot, which she knows she doesn't have now. And then he gives her this barley. He gives her basically a symbol of what this promise means. So she walks out of there holding over 30 pounds of barley in her garment, however she would manage that. And so she's got this physical sign. This is the promise of being redeemed. This is my life change right here. But it's not quite fully realized yet. But she leaves that threshing floor with the promise that changes her life, although it's not fully received yet. So if we look at Adam and Eve back in the garden, so in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, stuff is pretty good. Adam and Eve are living in perfect relationship with each other. They're in perfect relationship with God. They're in perfect relationship with animals. And they're in perfect relationship with all the earth. They can walk around, they never have a marital fight, and they can go pet a lion. Like, that's their life. And then they take afternoon walks with God. This is their life. And they're naked. Like, this is amazing. This is their life right now. Pretty good. But then a death happens. Not a physical death, but a spiritual death and an emotional death. Sin enters in chapter 3, and death happens. And that death affected every single aspect of Adam and Eve's life. They are no longer in perfect relationship with each other. They're no longer in perfect relationship with God. And now, they can't go touch a lion. You can look up YouTube videos, probably, of what happens when you go up and try to touch a lion. We are not in perfect relationship with animals anymore. That death that occurred in chapter 3 affected everything. But God gave them this promise. He gave them a promise of a redeemer to come, but it's not yet fulfilled. So they leave the garden with a promise that it's not always going to be this way, but it's not yet. So they're in this in-between, just like Ruth is in this in-between right now in our scene. She has this promise, but it's not quite there yet. So you see kind of how those parallels line up with each other. So where do we come in is the question. We were not around for the death, but we get to have the effects of it. Have you ever, maybe if you're a parent, maybe you've had this situation. I've had this situation like one time, I think. Two of my kids were fighting. I come in to deal with it. I was sitting in another room, I don't know, drinking a LaCroix, just enjoying life. Hear the fight. I come into the fight. I'm trying to deal with the fight, and all of a sudden, I'm getting yelled at about something. Like, I'm sitting away from everything, and other people's sin is happening, and then I have to step into that, and then all of a sudden, I get thrown into the mix of this sin that's everywhere that I had nothing to do with. Well, that's where we're born into. We're born into someone else's mess that they created for us that we now have to deal with. So we weren't around for the death of the garden, but we have to deal with the results of someone else's sin. And so we're born into this mess. We're born into imperfect relationships. We're born into just imperfectness. And now we have a nature that we have to fight against that takes us into sin. But where we're different is we don't have the promise of a Redeemer. We actually get to look at the Redeemer. We get to see the Redeemer and the work that the Redeemer accomplished, and we get benefit because of that Redeemer's work. But it's not fulfilled yet. So you see, we're in a slightly different kind of in-between place, like Adam and Eve were and like Ruth is, where we have this benefit of a Redeemer, but it's not all the way fulfilled. So we have these amazing resources we have, but we still have to deal with sin. People still get sick and die. But we get to look forward to what it means to be fulfilled. So now imagine with me Ruth walking home. So Boaz has her get up before people can recognize, right? It's still dark and sends her home. And then I wonder about that, and I think about that, because Boaz also talks about how everyone in the city knew that Ruth was a stand-up person, right? That they knew her moral character. Does anyone remember who Boaz's mom is? Who is Boaz's mom? Rahab. Rahab was a prostitute that was in a city. Israelites were going to come take over the city. They came to her. She was terrified of the Israelites' God. And she said, I've heard about you, and I'm pretty confident you're going to come here and you're going to win. And I don't want to die. Like, I want to be on your team from what I've heard. And so she helps the spies, and they save her. So she goes from being a prostitute and gets rescued and brought into the Israelite culture. Imagine what Boaz would have heard as a kid. Now, I understand this isn't in the text, but as we talked about, people marrying themselves now, people are still people. Sin is still sin. You have to imagine that Boaz heard from people, your mom is just a whore. That's who your mom is. You're simply the son of a whore. So it's an amazing picture of Boaz trying to protect Ruth. You came, nothing immoral happened here, but man, I know what people are going to say about you. If they see this situation, it's going to be brutal and it's going to be tough. And I don't want you to be defined by a lie. So get up and go. You got to go now. So here's Ruth leaving, still kind of dark out. It's probably getting light as she's walking. She's carrying over 30 pounds of barley in her garment, whatever that means. And she's walking. Now imagine how elated she probably is. Her life is totally different. Her life has changed. In every single aspect, her life has changed now. So now imagine she walks by two women. She hears them kind of whispering to themselves, and they say, oh yeah, that's Ruth. That's that dirty Moabite. Now, 24 hours earlier, I would imagine her response would be like, yeah, I'm just that Moabite. That's who I am now. This day, No, I'm not the dirty Moabite. I'm the redeemed of Boaz. My life is not what it was 24 hours ago. My emotional life, my spiritual life, my economic life, everything about me is not that. I'm the redeemed of Boaz. Changes everything. Because imagine if she's walking, she's got this 30 pounds of barley, and she hears somebody whisper, oh, that's that dirty Moabite. Imagine she just drops the barley and goes, yep, that's right, I am the dirty Moabite, and just turns and walks away. She wouldn't do that because everything about her has changed. So I've got a couple questions I want to ask. And I haven't done it for a while, but when I say I have a couple questions I want to ask, what that means is I want to ask a couple questions, and then I want to have answers come back to those questions. Okay? It's going to be fun. We're going to get through it. Not rhetorical, though. We're going to participate together. Okay? First one is, what does it mean for us to be redeemed? So we've talked about that word, we've looked at what that means, and we see that Jesus is our Redeemer. So what does it mean for us to be redeemed? What does that mean? Or what resources does that give us? What does it mean to be redeemed? Holy Spirit, made new. Made new, yeah. Brought back into the family. More than conquerors, yeah. Paid for, yeah. Set free, yeah. What else? What does it mean to be redeemed?
Forgiven.
Forgiven. Yeah. Renamed. Become heirs to the kingdom. Yeah, an inheritance that's coming. Set aside as holy. You've been made different. Yeah. What else? What does it mean to be redeemed?
New identity.
New identity. Yeah. Unlimited resource. Yeah. So that's our list. This is what it means to be redeemed. The problem is, we live a lot of our life forgetting that. Stuff happens. Things go on and we start believing lies. Now there's a wide range of lies that we're told, ranging from what it means to be significant and to matter, all the way down to firefighters or heroes. Like there's this wide range of lies that we're consistently told. So the question is, where are the lies that you hear that cause you to forget that beautiful list of what it means to be redeemed? We just created a great list of what it means to be redeemed. So where are the lies that you hear, or what are the lies that you hear that cause you to forget that list of what it means to be redeemed? Unworthy. You can do it on your own. Yeah. I'm sick. Too complicated. Yeah. What else? Where are some of the lies that you hear? Not good enough. Yeah, you're unworthy. Can't be forgiven again. You screwed up this much, might as well. Yeah. Because there's no coming back from where you were. What's that? God maybe regret saving. What else? Miss the mark.
Just do what makes you happy.
Do what makes you happy. Seek pleasure. Cameron was talking about that. So many of these things are defined by like our worst choices, right? So imagine now, think about even in Boaz's context, you have Rahab. And imagine if she never was known as anything other than the whore. How often do we define people by their worst choices? And how often do we think people only define us by our worst choices? So how can God not? That's how we logically present it to ourselves. What's fun about doing something like this is, right, so in America, public speaking is the number one fear. Number two is death. People literally would rather die than get up and speak in public. So what we have is when I'm asking people to participate and get involved, it's kind of this game of how can I participate? Because I so desperately want to participate and I want to say something, but I want to flirt with the line of I don't want it to actually give away anything about me though. I just kind of want to give this super general like thing that people are like, oh yeah, that was a good answer, but then they don't actually know about anything that I'm struggling with. How about when my kids complain about the life that I've worked so desperately hard to provide for them? What about that lie? Well, what about when my wife complains and I interpret and hear it as, you're not good enough to be my husband? What about that lie? What about the lie of you needing a spouse to complete you? When people hear that lie, what's the answer? Marry yourself. You have to come up with an answer to the lies that you hear. You have to. So when you hear those lies, there's an answer. And if it's away from God, then you end up and you're looking around and you're saying, am I at a wedding ceremony for one person right now? I'm going to take my toaster back. You have to come up with an answer for the lie. So if we have our list of this is what it means to be redeemed. This is where we're hearing lies that have us forget what it means to be redeemed. The last question that I want to ask is where do you turn, or what patterns do you have, or where do you wish you turned more to remind you of what it means to be redeemed when you're hearing those lies? Where are places that you turn for reminders? Or what do you do to remind yourself of what it means to be redeemed when you're hearing lies? Word of God, Bible. That's a good answer, yeah. Truth. Community. Okay. First service took so long to say community. So it turns out at Gospel Life, we have something called gospel communities here, which is a group of people that gather together that proclaim truth when you're listening to lies. It's pretty important. Where else? Where else do you turn to remind yourself of what it means to be redeemed when you're believing lies? Being of service. Where else? Music. Yeah. Especially there's some great music that has truth in it that connects in different ways than reading it or hearing it. Yeah.
Good sermons.
Good sermons. Puts a lot of pressure on me right now. I didn't like that answer. Good sermons, hearing truth proclaimed. So how we combat lies is with truth. And how do we have truth perpetually around us? How do we set up reminders of truth around us? Intentional relationships. Yeah, intentional relationships. I want to look at another passage. It's in 2 Peter. I think we have it up. So Peter, in chapter 1, Peter spends a few verses outlining effectively what it means to be redeemed. We can call it a lot of different things, but he outlines kind of what this means to be redeemed. And in verse 9, he says, "For whoever lacks these qualities is so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed of his former sins." The picture I want you to have in your head is Rahab lugging massive weight of barley and hearing that, oh, that's that Moabite girl. And her just dumping it and walking away. You're right. I am that Moabite girl. That's the picture I want you to have. We're so blind. We're so nearsighted. We've forgotten that we've been cleansed of our former sins. This is that moment of, I know what it means to be redeemed. I hear the lie, and I'm all in with the lie. I've just dumped the resource that my Redeemer has given me because of his work, and I'm in the lie. A couple verses later, Peter picks up in verse 12, and he says, "Therefore, I intend always to remind you of these qualities, though you know them and are established in the truth that you have. I think it right, as long as I am in this body, to stir you up by way of reminder, since I know that the putting off of my body will be soon, as our Lord Jesus Christ made clear to me. And I will make every effort so that after my departure, you may be able at any time to recall these things." At any time to recall these things. You know, the Pharisees did this thing where they took Bible verses and they like tied them to their forehead. And they put them on their doorposts and all this. And we look at that stuff and we kind of make fun of them. We're like, "Oh, freaking Pharisees, yeah, you guys suck." The thing is, how most of them started, though, were really well-intentioned. We look at it now and see it's legalism because they then turned into, "I'm better than you because I do these things." But putting verses up, writing a verse on your bathroom mirror to help you remember the truths of God, that's not legalism, guys. That might actually be smart. Having Bible verses on sticky notes in your car, that's not legalism. They're reminders. Maybe for some of you, having reminders in the car is the best place for you to have them because of how you drive. Or no, sorry. Because of how other people drive, not because of how you drive. But having reminders. So you can recall these things at any time. In those moments that lie hits. In those moments that's what you're hearing. In those moments where it's, "I need this to be happy. I need this to complete me." In those moments, "I need internet pornography. I need alcohol. I need a spouse. I need a better spouse. I need my kids to just listen one time and then I'll be happy. I need a better education. I need a different job. I need a different kind of job. I need a promotion. I need a raise. I need to recall these things at any time. How do we do that? We have to have reminders around us. Through community, through music, through whatever that looks like for you, how do we take that list? This is what it means to be redeemed. Because you're going to hear these lies. And when you hear them, I want you to hear one of the other reasons why I like having this out loud is because so often we think we struggle with really unique things that no one else understands. And so you're not special. I get everyone is a snowflake and you all get a medal and everybody's good. But at the same time, you're not. Your struggles are not unique just to you and no one else understands what you're going through. That's not it. We lie to ourselves and we isolate ourselves. I can't talk about that. I can't bring that up because no one else struggles with that. And then they're just going to look down on me. No. Hopefully you're hearing some of these things come out in a group. "Oh man, yeah, oh, man, I buy into that lie too. Oh, yeah, that's really hard for me too." You're not on your own. We all have this resource that God's given us and we got it bundled up and we're carrying it and then we hear something. We hear the, "You're this, you're not worthy, you're not good enough," and we just take it and we just dump it and we walk away. We need people around us helping us grab hold of that. Sanctification is not the ability to just hold on to it longer. "I've gotten a little stronger. I can just hang on a little bit more." Sanctification is having people around you that help you lift it up. That's what community is. That's what those reminders are around you. It's in those moments to remember them at any time, not just church Sunday morning, not just while I'm singing special praise music that I have, not just when I'm around these certain people, at any time to be able to remember what it means to be redeemed. I guarantee you, Ruth walking home, I don't think anyone could have said anything to her to make her think, "Oh yeah, I am just that dirty Moabite." Nothing would have shaken what just happened to her because it changed every aspect of her entire life. So let's not take our resource and just dump it. As we enter into communion, this is another reminder. Rob talked about how we take communion every single week. We don't do it legalistically. We don't do it to say, hey, what churches don't do communion every week? Awesome. Better than that one, that one, that one. That's not what we're doing here. What we are saying is, man, we want as many reminders as we can get. And that's what communion is, right? The cracker and the cup, we didn't buy it from a store that has this back entrance that goes into Narnia, okay? It's just a cracker. It's just some juice. That's all it is. It's nothing. But what it says is, God, you have redeemed me out of slavery and out of poverty and out of nothingness, and you have handed to me resource that is beyond comparison. I don't want to just dump it and believe lies anymore. I want to believe truth. This is another reminder that we set up to regularly step into. That's what this communion time is. So I want you thinking about that as we walk into the communion table. Don't just throw your resource down when you hear those lies. Understand that that list that we created together, that's a good list. This is what it means to be redeemed. When you hear those lies, they're going to come up and they're going to happen. Have those reminders to speak truth louder than how you're hearing those lies.